You guys have been with me for a while in Philippians, and it's been, I would say, better for me than for y'all, but it has been a real experience to see this church at Philippians and the way Paul writes to them. It's been very encouraging. It's one of the few books where Paul just doesn't rip them a new one. You know, it really is. He just kind of goes in and says, I love you. You're different. You're a different church. I'm not going to lay you and fillet you open so that we can see everything that's wrong with you so that I can deal with it. So he has written an epistle of joy, a letter of joy to these Philippians. And I think if you've gotten as much or even part of what I've gotten out of it, we have seen that theme of joy. We have seen that expanding into unity. And we have seen that where he goes off into last week, sanctification. And you'd think that Paul might be skipping around a little bit, but the next few verses, and it's chapter 2, verses 14 through 16, you'd think that he kind of went off on a tangent, just casual reading, but he doesn't. Paul's continuing that statement where he says, you know, I'm going to work out my salvation and God's going to work in me. And he's saying that, you know, here's what we need to do. And he jumps right into grumbling and complaining. It doesn't sound like that's always connected, but it is. It is. We have lives that are filled with opportunities to grumble and complain. I mean, I don't know how deeply into the day you got before you complained yourself, heard someone else complain, or heard somebody on the radio complaining. I did. And I was kind of aware for it. I was listening for it because I wanted to see. And it was literally minutes before I heard somebody going, oh, woe is me. Oh, blah, blah, blah. So this book is progressing through sanctification. Our right is joy. Our mode of doing things is unity. Our desire should be to be sanctified more and more every day. And one of the things he gets quickly into is probably what we all suffer from is this entitlement to complain. Not about everything, but anything. Anything that bumps against our foot, we can complain about. Anything we see with our eye, we can complain. Anything we hear with our ear, we can complain. Any lack, anything that's too much, we can complain. I'm going to read the scripture here, and then we'll pray, and then I'll get into this. It says Philippians 2, 14 through 16, and I'm reading out of the New American Standard, and y'all probably have all the different versions. 14, do all things without grumbling or disputing, so that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I will have reason to glory, because I did not run in vain, nor toil in vain. I know we probably all read that passage before, and it kind of made us feel good. I'm not a complainer. This isn't necessarily about me. And man, I am surrounded by a crooked and perverse generation. And I'm going to hold fast. It isn't about me per se. And like I said, I didn't get very far into the day before I heard a grumble and complaint, and it was me. It was me. I was the grumbler. I was the complainer. I didn't get very much farther before I heard sweet little Connie complain about a couple of things. And we all know that Connie never says anything ill, or she doesn't grumble. Grumble even sounds like what it is. You know that word you learned in high school, onomatopoeia? The word you cannot spell? I don't care how you try it. It's got more vowels than Czechoslovakian names have consonants. It's just out there. I know how to say it. I can't spell it. When you say grumble, you get the sense of what you're doing. It's like, it's the snarl. It's the walk-away comment that your kids do when they're going, and you go, what did you say? You know what they're saying. They're grumbling. It doesn't sound like anything. It sounds like they're clearing their throat and cursing you at the same time. We get grumbling. We know grumbling. There's no doubt what grumbling is. I'm reminded that there are extremes, though. I was talking to Terry Dorsey one day, and he just lifted his arm up, and it looked like he'd had a heart attack, you know, because he had that shoulder injury. And he goes, oh, my shoulder. And his face drains of blood, you know, and he looks like he's about to pass out. And I go, he didn't say much, but man, his face spoke volumes. And I go, that's not a complaint. That's a real injury. And then there's the constant at our house, man, this old body ain't what it used to be. This old body isn't quite holding up like I thought it was. Connie's is. Mine's the one that's fallen to pieces. But then there's the other end of it. Like, you know, boy, it's been a rough day. We had a 6.1 earthquake today. I can't find my children, and I don't know what I'm going to eat tomorrow. That's a little bit different complaint. Those are sort of extremes, right? And there's even that farther extreme where we hear Jesus complain. Do you guys remember that? Josh says he remembers. What was it? Well, I thought he was going on attack mode there, but yeah, he did. The one I'm thinking of is, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Is that a complaint? It's in the form of a prayer, but he's still going, hey, wait a minute. You know, he knew what he signed up for, but he was still going, you know, wait a minute. I don't think there was sin involved in that, but I want you to see that somewhere between this body ain't what it used to be, and my God, why hast thou forsaken me, is a land of sin and landmines. That's called complaining and grumbling. And the reason that's so important, if you don't remember anything about this lesson, I'm going to tell you what it is now, I'm going to tell you what it is then, is your grumbling isn't just heard by you or your wife or your kids who are walking away going, rrr, rrr. It isn't just that moment. You do it out of habit everywhere you are. And that is what gets between you and that gospel that God wants to share with everybody else. That Christ, He wants you to show to everybody else. That light of the world you're supposed to be. If you're a grumbler, if you're a complainer, if you're a whiner, a whimperer, a loser and a lost, I don't want to be like you. I don't want to be like you. I want to be like the victors. I want to be the ones who are, man, life is one big challenge and I've got one great big God helping me push right through it. That's the ones I want to hang with. The ones who are grumbling all the time, man, that's pitiful. But remember, your witness and the person next to you, they're waiting for you to be different. They don't want you to be just like them. They want you to be totally different, or they'll totally reject you. You have to be totally different, or they'll totally reject you. I remember a funny story about complaining, and it's how easy we look at complaining and grumbling. And you might think you're the only one complaining in a conversation, but I talked with my dad once. I know we were working because that's all I ever did when I saw him was work. I mean, it was like, boy, and then there was work involved. And so we had to been standing around a lawnmower or cleaning up a garage or washing a car or something. And I said something, and I'm going to quote this because I remember it clearly. It says, "You kids don't want to do without, save or work for anything." Your own dad said this. Don't tell me he didn't. In my day, we worked hard for what we got, and we appreciated it. And my dad was a very colorful speaker, and so right behind that was, bam, bam, you know. And I go, man, he's right. I'm so unthankful, you know. I didn't. I was complaining. He complained right back about what a worthless child I was. You know, it's a game, right? It's really a game. Complaining is a game now. I had a chance to talk to my grandfather a little while later, and I sort of talked to him about that. I said, you know, is this true? And he goes, well, let me tell you my story. And I'm going to tell you this because it sounded exactly like my dad. He said, you kids don't want to do without, save, or work for anything. In my day, we worked hard for what we got, and we appreciated it. And he wasn't quite as colorful, so he just kind of sat there. But my grandfather also admitted that he might have been wrong, but he also said, I heard it from my father, too. My dad said the same thing about me. And I'm going to tell you, you hang around about 2 or 3 days in our house, you're going to hear me say the exact words to my kids. And they're going to go, but Dad, does that sound like bam, 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 a tennis match of complaints? It really does. We're not satisfied with what we have, and we're not satisfied that our children want more. I'm also reminded of a crazy story. I tell my wife this, the beautiful and talented Connie, that it was pretty hard. We were going to go to a family reunion. And you know what those are like, filled with colorful older people, crazy cousins you haven't seen in 2 years, a lot more facial hair and fat than you were used to seeing, and kids you never even knew existed. So a family reunion is, it's a pretty interesting experience. We have a huge family, and my mom would sit with her five sisters around a campfire or, you know, around in easy chairs. And she also had five brothers who had wives just like them. So there'd be these 11 ladies, looked like a coven of witches, you know. And one of them would go, you know, I had a hangnail the other day. And literally within a heartbeat, somebody would go, oh, and I broke a finger. And then from across the campfire was, and I tripped and fell, and I have 9 stitches in my knee. And all of a sudden, it would be all the way up to triple bypass surgery. You've been there, right? And we called it, the cousins would be circling the coven, looking for money, popcorn, candy, whatever. You know what family reunions are like. A Band-Aid, first aid. We'd be looking for that. And they'd be doing the dueling ailments. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Triple bypass surgery. They had to one-up each other. It wasn't that we were now complaining about each other. We had to one-up each other. And that's what we do. That's what complaining is. It's a culture now. And my mom is one of the 4 or 5 ladies in that generation left. And she's in a nursing home. And she's got recurring cancer, heart disease, has had the triple bypass surgery, probably is missing a toe by now, has had recent surgery. And I'll bet you, if Aunt Violet got in the room, the game would start. I guarantee you, we are entitled to complain. We're almost encouraged to, aren't we? Well, Paul was pretty clear in the previous verses that, you know, while that kind of stuff is pretty funny, he's talking about working out our salvation. The words that come out of your mouth are you working out your salvation. The situations you allow yourself to be in are you working out your salvation. And my mom, my Aunt Violet, my Aunt Ruby, my Aunt Martha, you know, all those sweet old ladies in isolation became this pod of complaint. They weren't evidence of a saving Christ to me as an early growing up kid. And I and my 53 cousins circling these ladies just thought they'd lost their minds. We really did. How could life be so horrible? We were at a lake, man. We were playing from dawn till dusk. Somebody was always cooking us food. Life was good. We thought it was good. But we weren't aware because we were children. And they should have been aware because they say they were raised in Christian homes, that they had this opportunity to work out their salvation. And they weren't doing it. They were living the life of the world. And the first thing it says in verse 15, and I'm just going to assume y'all agree that we should do all things without grumbling or disputing. We should. But I'm going to go into verse 15. It says that you may prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God above reproach. We know that when we work out our salvation, we're supposed to be working toward a goal. And if you don't know that goal, and I'm confident you do, but I will say it, it's righteousness. Not righteousness in our own eyes, but righteousness in the eyes of God. He gets to define it because He gets to actually punish and reward based on that definition at the end of time. We're in a game, and we've all been there. If I don't like the way the game's going, I'm going to pick up my ball and go home, or I'm going to steal your ball and run. You know, we do that. We change the rules of the game. But with Christ, there is no changing the rule. We're supposed to provide ourselves to the world as meek lambs, as blameless and innocent. And you know what the world does with that? They'll kick you from this end to that end. But, you're supposed to be blameless and innocent regardless of how the world acts. we're going to be children of God above reproach. And I like the above reproach because it means that we're blameless, flawless, faultless, sinless. We're pure. Do you guys feel pure? Do you guys feel pure? Do you feel pure? Kind of a hard one to grab, isn't it? I don't feel pure all the time. I really don't. It's tough to grab. But it is something you can claim. But it must be the fruit of your working out your salvation. It must be the fruit of it. You must behave. You must conform to God's plan. How do you do that? I'm going to tell you, I am glad this is a process. And I'm also glad that Christ will finish the process at the end of my life of sanctifying me and purifying me. Because the traction I'm making right now is pitiful. Do y'all feel the same way sometimes? That you're just not making much headway. And I think I was telling Kathy or Connie this. I said, man, I think I spend 10 hours a week reading my Bible and scrummaging through all the notes and comparing and stuff like that. Man, I'm getting the Word. But I'm just not making much headway sometimes. I'm glad Christ is going to pick up the slack between wherever He can get me till I die to that eventual salvation where He meets me and welcomes me into heaven. I'm glad of that. Because, quite frankly, y'all, I'm about as pathetic as people come. And after watching a few of y'all, I can say we're in the same boat. Let's paddle together, okay? But God intends for us to be blameless and innocent. And I think we can find evidence for that because He went to the cross. That cross I talked about a couple of weeks ago, the one that was so pitiful and so demeaning. He went to that cross willingly for us. And then of His own power, He came back out of the grave. And we saw that at the Trail of Life. And nothing is as dramatically evident of Christ coming back as an empty tomb. And I've never been to the real place where Christ was placed in a tomb. I don't know if y'all have either. But we represented out there with, I guess, roofing paper and framework. And a guy with glasses was standing inside. Why do you look for Him here? You know, and I know that was a meager representation, but I can let my mind run wild and see that that empty tomb is sufficient. And it always was planned to be sufficient to give us that ideal of godliness, that Christ lived life that would lead us and give us an example. It is enough. It is enough. Have you ever met Christ face to face? I've not. But have you ever seen Christ in the face of a friend or a brother or sister? I have indeed. I have indeed. A few years ago, I went through kind of a long spell of illness and surgery after surgery, it seemed like. And I wrote a letter to some people afterwards and I said, you know, I saw Christ's face reflected in yours, in your face. When you served my family, you took my kids in 18 below weather to the Trail of Christmas, the Town Lake Trail of Lights. They came to get our kids. They shopped for our Christmas gifts. They brought us food to eat. And they prayed for me. I mean, the list of prayers we have, it bound. It looks like a spiral notebook of the prayers that people sent us and the prayers that were orchestrated for us. I saw the face of Christ. You know who it was? It was those non-grumblers. The people who at that moment chose not to take on the face of their entitled life and grumble about what I don't have or what I do have that is wrong. I saw Christ's face. And if you've looked, you've seen that yourself. You've seen that yourself. Kathy came to stay with us for a few weeks. Maybe it was just 2 weeks. You guys lived in California at the time, right? You flew back from California. And I could have sworn she came to see me die. Because I came home from the hospital. I was totally, totally wiped out. But I just thought she was there to hold Connie's hand while I croaked. But I knew what the deal was. She came because that was Christ living out in her. She wanted to be with her sister while she suffered. She wanted to be with us while hopefully she saw God working in us and helping me recover. And He did. and we have minor miracles all along the way, but we have to remember that we need to prove ourselves blameless and innocent, but that's a hard work. That's a hard work. But when we see it, when we see blameless and innocent, I think we know it. I think we know blameless and innocent. I think we see pure and we go, man, I covet that. This might be one time where that commandment, thou shalt not covet, is one where you can break. I covet purity, y'all. When I see it in you, I want it. Not out of your storehouse, but of the one that God has set up for me. Another thing, in verse 15, it says that we're to work out our salvation by being blameless and innocent. That's meant for our benefit, you know, our sanctification. The next part of sanctification, and this is the point. The reason we've got to be working out our salvation is we're in the midst of a perverse and crooked generation. And by that, they mean a generation, not just 15 or 20 years worth of people. That's this one. That's the people that are alive now and the culture we live in. We're in a crooked and perverse generation. You know that? We have people who want to make you stumble and then put you on TV for it. You ever seen that show, Cheaters? I actually stumbled on it yesterday and watched some guy catching his girlfriend with some other guy. And I thought, man, we're setting people up to sin, to fail. I had a boss once who went into a restaurant and unknown to him, there was a camera on the cash register area, and it wasn't to keep people from stealing. It was to catch people keeping money when they were given too much change, just to see how crooked people were. It was a news story. And my boss gives them like a $20 bill and pays for his lunch, and he gets like $10 too much change. And he kind of looks at himself and kind of looks at his hands and he goes, wait a minute. He realized something was wrong. He takes his money back out of his pocket and he goes, you gave me too much money. And he gives him the $10 back. And that was part of the news story. And I go, wow, way to go, Dr. McKinney. High five, you know, good job. And I realized that was a habit he had of, you know, just being kind of a scrupulous guy. Because he was a doctor. He was a public servant. He was a thoughtful kind of guy. But he lived in a generation that actually wants to see you stumble. Whether you're a Christian or not, they want to see you make a fool of yourself. And the reason we do that, y'all, the reason we want other people to fail is it lowers the bar every time. That's the practical thing, I think, is it lowers the bar on what is sin, what is acceptable. We want it to be okay to keep the extra $5 that somebody gives us at the cash register. It's free $5. I've heard my kids say that. Hey, it was free $5. I go, how free? You willing to sell your soul for $5? How free? I know one of my relatives whose mother thought enough of either lying or stealing to put a sign on his back. She wasn't, this is a liar. This is a thief. Whatever it was, I was so impressed. I went, wow, let's get a sign. For our kids, you know, this has got to work. Because I think it embarrassed him to death. But that was somebody who was holding the line against that evil degradation of Christ's standards. The reason these standards are literally eternally important is because we're going to be the only people that will hold Christ's standard in this world. We are going to be the light. We're going to be the way and the truth and the light, right? We're going to have that light that's not to be hidden under a bushel. We're going to be that. Or we're going to be absolutely worthless. So you're going to be a witness no matter what. So if we know that God's purpose is seeking and saving the lost, He's giving us that opportunity to live that pure and blameless, that innocent life out in the open to impact other people. To do that. I mean, I think that's remarkable. God is going, ta-da, you get to be on stage. You get to be the man today. You get to reflect me. You get to show my face like those people who prayed for me. That was Christian to Christian. But I got some of the craziest responses from people at my job because they were on that email list of these prayers that were flying back and forth when I was so sick. And I finally went back to work and half a dozen people go, man, you got a crazy church. those are some praying people. I said, you have no idea. You have no idea. And it was the coolest thing to not even have to worry about my own witness, but to share someone else's witness too. I could say, man, that Renee is just a ball of fire. Boy, that Sharon Barton, that Connie, you know, that those people were such servants to me. I couldn't do anything. I memorized the pattern on our ceiling because I laid in bed so long. I literally could see the little fat guy, the little clouds, the wiener dog with no body. He just had a tail and a head. I know they're there. I could go back to that house right now and find the little wiener dog with no body. I could do it. But you know what? Around that, there were people who were lights to us. To other Christians, yeah, that's sort of easy. But when I went back to work, and you talk about an evil and crooked and a perverse generation, let's get a job at the city of Austin. It's a freak show, y'all. They don't let you talk about Jesus unless you're using it as a curse word. And then feel free, you know, feel free. But you would not imagine, or maybe you would, what an impact that makes. When you go into your workplace and you say, yeah, I'm different. And you saw evidence of my people. Not my people per se, but God's. You saw evidence that they really prayed for us. People bought our kids their Christmas gifts because we couldn't go out and shop. They refused to take our money. They gave our kids money to buy us Christmas gifts and refused to take our money to pay them back. I saw Christ's face. And the crazy thing is, sometimes he had a mustache, sometimes he had gray hair, sometimes he was a little fat, sometimes he was a little short guy. They looked like everybody in this crowd right here. I'm not saying who the short guy, fat guy is. But he looked like us. He looked just like me. He looked just like Wanda and Richard. Those are the kind of people that are living a light life. Pretty good. It's pretty good. We're also supposed to, in that witness, supposed to hold out the word of life. You see that? Holding fast or forth the word of life so that in the day of Christ I will reason to glory. We're supposed to hold fast or hold forth that word. And I like what it said in one of the commentaries. It said, it wasn't just hold fast, which means to grasp it so as not to lose it. But it was hold forth, like to offer as a gift the gospel to the world. That is our true calling, to offer forth the gospel to the world, right? Isn't it, Johnny? That's our calling. That's the Christian's job, is to hold forth that gospel. Another thing that, as we're working out our salvation, I want you all to look at this verse because it really is funny. And I'm going to speak this as fast as I can so it doesn't sound even weirder than that. It says, so that in the day of Christ, verse 16, I may have cause to rejoice because I did not run in vain nor toil in vain. Is he talking about you running in vain? Or is he talking about Paul running in vain? Do you see that clearly? So that he says, I. It's the author. So that I'll say it wasn't in vain. He says, I, Paul, may have cause to rejoice because I, Paul, did not run in vain nor toil in vain. Why is it important that we make Paul happy? Why is our working out our salvation so important to Paul? Well, I'm gonna make a stretch here, and you guys stay with me. But I'm not the pastor of this church. I work for the pastor of this church. The pastor of this church has dedicated his life to you guys. You get that? James in his wee hours of the morning, staying up and getting calls from God, even when he's in the restroom, and visions and stuff. This is real stuff. This is a man dedicated to God. And he's pouring himself into you. He's pouring himself into you. And if you're in the men's prayer time like Richard and a couple of other guys sitting there in here, on Sunday morning you're hearing us pray over James and with James, and you'll hear Steve White say, hide James behind the cross. Don't you hear it every Sunday morning? Literally, don't you, Richard? And you'll hear the rest of us go, you know, don't make James proud. Make James say the word that God has for him. We're saying all these things. We're saying, Let James be this, lest James be less and Christ be more. But in the end we go, the world's going to attack James. The world's going to attack James's family. The world is going to punish James for his righteousness. Because frankly, the world approves of sin and disapproves of righteousness. Isn't that kind of a weird economy? They want you to agree that it's okay to lie if you don't really lie that much. It's okay to curse if you're the governor of Texas. It's okay to have an affair. It's okay to have a homosexual relationship. Those are accepted. But when we try to pass our righteousness, our gospel off to somebody, that's a little too limiting. Sorry, it's not welcome. The world's perverse again. And our pastor is standing out there going, hey, listen, at some expense to himself, he's getting up there and saying, you know, I'm reading God's word. He says, this is wrong. And you respond and you change your lives because of the word of God, not James's eloquence. I've heard better pastors. I've never known and loved one more. But I've seen and heard better preachers. But I've never known one who loved God's word more. Never. So I want you to understand that the glory here, the rejoicing, is James's. Is that pastor you sat under for 10 years, a long time ago. Those people are going to get an eternal glory, not a temporal fame or even claps on the back or taken out to dinner or whatever. Those are appreciation, and he loves that. But the thing that our pastor and the pastors who served us in years past, you're working out your salvation, your righteousness is part of his eternal glory. He looks back on it and Christ goes, well done. Well done. You get credit for it, but James is dedicating his life to you. And this isn't a homily or what do you call it, a eulogy to James or whatever. It's nothing like that. But I want you to understand that there are people who pour their lives into you and who love you and who try to live a life worthy of the calling of the gospel so that you can imitate it. And I can tell you, it is a daunting thing to do. It's challenging, it's fun, but at times you find yourself broken for the pain that you see people that you love go through. You are absolutely overwhelmed with love because so many people appreciate what you do. But you're also humbled by the fact that you can really mess up people's lives if you don't do it well. And so it is tough to be your pastor. I thank Jesus that I am not your pastor. I am someone who works for your pastor. And I just want to tell you that when you get that chance to live out your calling, you're working out your salvation, there is some glory in that. It isn't just you being made whole or better, and that isn't your pastor. Never let it be said that James covets glory, or my pastor when I was a kid, Clyde Kane, don't know where he lives today, but he was the pastor when I was saved, and my life is some glory to him because he poured into our church. The true glory goes to God. It all goes to God. Not because he just a pig about it. He's not. That's just the economy of heaven and righteousness, that all glory goes to God. It's appropriate that we honor God with that glory, with our lives. And so there's a dual purpose there in honoring your pastor. It's because that in turn gives God glory for those lives well lived. So I don't want to go too much farther because while the verses were good, I think you saw them coming. You saw them coming. We're not supposed to be complainers. Everybody knows that. As much as Aunt Ruby and Aunt Martha were sweet little ladies, one of them could count every chigger bite on her leg and throw that into the mix with the triple bypass surgery. You know, it was everything from chigger bites to brain tumors. I mean, literally was. And you wondered, how are you sitting by a fire on a 100-degree night? Okay. People will complain no matter what. But I often told my mom, you have nothing to complain about. You have me as a son. My wife has met my mother. She's a champion. She found ways around that to complain. But so we are to stop complaining. It's common sense. It's also a command from the Word to stop complaining. When you stop complaining, it's evidence that you are working out your salvation. It's evidence of that. We're going to be exchanging unrighteous for righteous. So it comes at a cost, doesn't it? I like to complain. I really do. It's a sport. It really is. And while I am not a champion, I was raised by one. So it's in my bloodline to be a champion complainer. So I told you that the purpose of God included reaching the lost. And if you didn't get anything out of tonight's lesson, it's you are all that most people will ever see of Jesus Christ. And if you're grumbling, if you're complaining, and you hear weird banjo music in the background because the guy next to you is trying to one-up you, you are a complainer. And that's not going to bring any glory to you, your pastor, your wife, your daughter, your son, this church, or Jesus Christ Himself. So it was common sense stuff. You didn't miss it. But I hope it didn't leave you with too bad of an impression of my family. They are a bunch of whack nuts, but they're all I got, and I am what I am.